Now it's the week in Washington. We're going to check in on several developing stories in national politics. Congress is continuing to face pressure to pass some kind of coronavirus relief package, as well as a government funding measure. And President-elect Biden continues to announce picks for his incoming administration. This week, we've learned more about what he'd like his economic and communications teams to look like. And yesterday, Attorney General Bill Barr was interviewed by the AP and said that the Department of Justice investigation into possible widespread election fraud, such as the current president has said happened, yielded nothing that would overturn the results of the election. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this statement from the Attorney General? Does that what does it make you think about ongoing challenges to election results? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah Ferris is a congressional reporter for Politico. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with Attorney General Barr. This started last month when Barr announced that U.S. attorneys around the country could look into irregularities in voting. What did we hear from him this week about the investigation results?
That's right. So Attorney General Barr gave a pretty blockbuster interview to the Associated Press this week where he declared that there was no widespread election fraud, basically contradicting what President Trump and his allies have been saying ever since November 3rd. He said that U.S. attorneys and FBI agents were following up on specific complaints that they had heard from around the country. But he said, as they've been reviewing that, there hasn't been anything that actually presents itself as evidence that there has been election fraud. So this was a really, really big deal. There's a lot of Trump allies who did not expect AG Barr to go against the president in this way. He's been basically on the president's side lockstep throughout his term. So this was a pretty big deal.
What have we heard from the president, his campaign, and his supporters about the attorney general's comments?
So Rudy Giuliani, who, of course, is a Trump ally, released a pretty scathing statement right after the fact, saying there was, quote, no semblance, end quote, of an investigation by the attorney general's office, basically saying that they weren't doing enough. They're pressuring Barr and others to do more, to look into some of these allegations of fraud that the Trump team has been making. Right now, as we speak, the president is taking part in a lengthy speech that he called potentially the most important of his presidency, where he seems to just be repeating claim after claim of this unsubstantiated election fraud. So that's happening right now. We'll be, you know, looking into what comes out of that, if anything. But right now, what I'm hearing from my colleagues who've been watching that is that there's nothing new to that. He's just repeating these claims. And, you know, I think we can interpret that as a reaction to what Barr came out and said to the Associated Press this week. I think, you know, the president is of course, going to be upset that one of his top allies went out against him in this way, which, you know, Democrats in Congress would say, well, this is confirming the results of a Democratic election. And why would something that the attorney general says, you know, saying this was a safe election, why is this something the president is rattled by? But of course, his own reelection is on the line here.
There's been a lot of attention on Republicans in Congress. Has there been much in the way of movement since the initial round of, you know, some Republican senators who you'd kind of expect to be the first to recognize Biden's election? Has there been any kind of movement among Republicans who hadn't spoken up yet?
So what we've been seeing is this kind of awkward dance where established Republicans, some of the more institutionalists, are saying, look, you know, elections have consequences. President Trump did not win in as many states as he did. And that means Joe Biden is the victor here. But of course, there's this undercurrent among Republicans who are looking to these really crucial Georgia Senate races in January. So there's a large chunk of the Republican conference in the Senate in particular. You know, those are the voices that really matter, given they're still in charge of the Senate over there. They've been really careful to still say, you know, if Biden wins, we're starting to see, you know, some top Republicans start to mention, you know, the new administration, not specifically citing out Biden by name, but just noting, you know, there will be a new administration coming in January. But for the most part, they really want to remain lockstep behind Trump. They are really looking to, you know, basically try to bring out the Trump base into these two Georgia races. And so you can't do anything that's going to really tick off the president and you know, cause him to erupt in some way against Senate Republicans when you have these, you know, as I said, really critical elections that will determine the fate of the majority. Right now, it looks like the Senate will remain Republican. Democrats have this kind of long shot bid of winning over two seats. But again, you know, there's a reluctance of Senate Republicans to go out and go against Trump when so much is on the line.
And in Georgia, now we've got the president criticizing the Republican governor, Republican secretary of state, pushback from them and other Republican officials in the election administration. And then today, the attorney Sidney Powell, who was formerly on the president's team, is now off it, but still filing lawsuits, trying to overturn election results, held a rally. And some of the rally speakers were encouraging people to, in effect, boycott the Georgia Senate races if candidates there, Republican candidates, didn't take Trump's side in election disputes. So that's got to worry Republicans if they're telling Republicans are telling other Republicans not to vote for Republicans.
Yeah, it's really hard to stay up to date in the latest twists and turns of this. I mean, as you said, you know, you have Republicans in the state who are kind of arguing with election officials, arguing with each other. And there's just these, you know, really big, you know, conflicts that are coming to a head at this time that really Republicans do not want to miss their shot. So I think there's going to have to be a unification of the party here. You know, there's not that many weeks left. And I think there's going to be some more pressure to have, you know, Trump and his folks campaigning there, doing more appearances, that sort of thing. But of course, on the ground level, there's just so many different personalities and different disputes that are breaking out. You know, so it's definitely going to be one to watch.
We're talking to Sarah Ferris, congressional reporter for Politico. It's our weekly look at some of the biggest news in national politics. Coming up, stop me if you've heard this one before. Members of Congress are trying to negotiate a COVID-19 economic relief package. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Democrats and Republicans in the House and Senate come together on a plan? Small plan? Big plan? Targeted, focused, or broad strokes? What do you want to see in such a plan if it can be reached? What's riding on it for you? Expiring unemployment benefits, that kind of thing, or your business needing help from the government? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now, we're picking up our Week in Washington conversation with Sarah Ferris from Politico. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Congress pass a COVID-19 economic relief package? Do you think they can? What would you want it to look like if they do pass something? Call in quick at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Sarah, this has been a perennial topic on this segment every week. What is the latest on COVID-19 economic relief negotiations?
So I don't want to call it a breakthrough yet, but we did see some really significant movement just a couple of hours ago from the Democrats. So there's been basically the biggest flurry of negotiations that we've seen since before the election happening this week. Of course, members are back on the Hill for the first time since before Thanksgiving, and this is really their final chance to get something done. So naturally, there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of people trying to, you know, finally get something moving. And we saw this week a group of bipartisan lawmakers put forward a $908 billion package, which is kind of on the lower end of what's been talked about on the Democratic side, much lower than their initial ask. So basically, they put out this number, 908, you know, thinking this could be maybe a magic number that gets both sides to the table. And today we saw Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer basically endorsing this bill. They're throwing their weight behind this $908 billion number. So the big question is whether Senate Republicans are willing to come up to this number. They've been talking a lot about a $500 billion package. It's, of course, much narrower than what this bipartisan group is talking about. So that's the number of the week, $908 billion. We have a couple of days. You know, they're hoping to get an agreement by the weekend to see if this is something they can put on the floor next week. I mean, I don't know what to say at this point. We've been here so many times before. It's just a matter of, you know, just seeing if the looming threat of these deadlines again at the end of December is going to make a difference here.
Are there any common themes here? Like everybody agrees that if they pass something, it's got to include X?
There's really not. And that's kind of what makes this so hard, right? I mean, you have a lot of consensus behind direct payments. That's the $1,200 to most American families that we saw come out earlier this year. You know, there is a lot of consensus behind that, but not everybody. There's a lot of consensus behind some kind of additional unemployment insurance. You'll remember earlier this year, it was $600 per week going out to help millions of people who had lost their jobs because of the pandemic. The number that would be replaced with has been anywhere from $200 a week, $300 a week. Democrats want it to be, you know, let's stick with the 600 or maybe go to 500. So there's all kinds of big general themes of this package that have a lot of support behind them. Unemployment insurance. Who doesn't want unemployment insurance for people who lose jobs in a pandemic? But the question is, you know, what's in the details? And, you know, you have a lot of skittish Republicans, these deficit hawks that have been kind of, you know, waiting to oppose something all these months and are coming out of the woodwork now. And, you know, it's just one of those really ugly fights. There's so many people involved. So many people have an emotional, have a financial, have a personal stake in this. And it's just not going to be easy to try to get done in the next 8 days in session. But that's what they're trying to do.
Let's bring on a caller. Connie is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Connie, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Connie?
Well, I just wanted to comment on how I do hope that they can pass a stimulus package again very, very soon, similar to the one we had last April.
How does this affect you, Connie, if I may ask?
Sure. I have been unemployed now for 7 months. That is, I'm still on furlough from my full-time job. I do have a part-time job that's been helping a great deal. But, you know, the $600 a week, it was not anything near my regular salary, but it did help so much. And I know a lot of the businesses are like the one I work for, where the first stimulus helped a lot, but still the clients and the work isn't coming back like it used to. So we still need help out here.
Connie, good luck to you. Thank you for calling in to share that with us. And that's, I think, who a lot of people in Wisconsin, in Congress, Sarah, have in mind. Those people who are unemployed or their businesses shut down or severely hampered long term because of the pandemic, right?
Exactly. I mean, there's so many parts of the initial CARES Act, that's what they're calling it, that over $2.2 trillion bill that was passed back in April, the only substantial aid package that has been passed through this pandemic. We haven't seen any new money since April. You know, there's a lot of really good things in that package that people said worked great. The problem is not everything did, not everything was right. And so there's members who just are reluctant to do that same thing again. And that's why we've been having this fight after fight is, you know, how do we improve the last package? What parts of it were unnecessary? You know, how do we make sure that money is really put to a good use? And that has caused these, you know, 6, 7, 8 months of delay here.
Thanks for that call, Connie. And just our last few moments, Sarah, the Biden team keeps emerging, the president-elect, to talk about who's going to be in his cabinet and other key posts. Briefly, what has struck you about what we've heard this week?
So this week, the Biden transition team unveiled their economic team, which, of course, is going to be such a huge part of the first 100 days of the Biden administration, the first 4 years of the Biden administration, because that's how long we're going to be seeing the impact of this recession. And Treasury Secretary, the nominee is Janet Yellen. She will be the first woman to hold that post, which is really remarkable. She's a really remarkable person. She's held all sorts of high level economic posts under Republican presidents, under Democratic presidents. She's really well respected on both sides of the aisle. She has held a pretty aggressive stance in terms of, you know, getting the economy going. And, you know, I think a lot of people think she'll be a good fit to take over for this, you know, really, really nasty economic downturn that she's going to be inheriting. The other really notable person is Neera Tanden, who is the nominee to lead the Office of Management and Budget, which is a wonky office, but really one of the most important branches of the White House. This is, of course, controlling for the entire federal budget, working really closely with Congress. Neera Tanden is remarkable, not only because she would be the first woman of color to hold that post, but she also she comes from a left of center think tank. She's had all kinds of positions in Democratic circles and is really well known and hailed by many progressives, but she really is controversial to a lot of Republicans. Her positions are not quite as middle of the line as Janet Yellen, and I think that nomination is going to encounter a lot of resistance in the Senate, which, as we were discussing earlier, unless there's a really unique scenario in the Georgia elections in January, will be retained by the Republicans. And Republicans will essentially have veto power over this nominee. So there's a lot of people watching to see if the Neera Tanden nomination can survive. Seems to be the only one so far that we've heard from the Biden administration that might not get through the Senate.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Sarah Ferris, congressional reporter for Politico, joining us for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. For decades, medical experts have been working to come up with treatments for Huntington's disease. It's a fatal genetic condition that hits adults in midlife and deteriorates the mind and body's functions. It's rare as diseases go, but still, just over 40,000 people have symptomatic cases in the U.S., with another 200,000 at risk of inheriting the condition. And finding a way to slow or stop the progressive changes could potentially lead to effective treatment for other neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. UW-Madison researchers are looking for people to participate in a study to help do that, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or a loved one have Huntington's disease? Have you decided to get tested for it, or would you rather not know? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jane Paulson is a research faculty member at UW-Madison's neurology department. She's preparing to run a study that would determine if the disease can be prevented. Jane, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
And Kelly Koberger is with us, a Wisconsin resident and a volunteer with the Wisconsin chapter of the Huntington's Disease Society of America. Huntington's disease runs in her family. Kelly, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, Jane, let's start with you. Can you tell us a little more about Huntington's disease, how people get it, and what it does?
Yes, it is a genetic condition, and actually, Rob, your description was pretty good. That means if it's genetic, it's autosomal dominant, meaning if your parent has it, you have a 50-50 chance of receiving it because you have a gene from your mother and one from your father. So you might, whichever one has the disease in their chromosomes, you have a 50-50 chance of getting that allele from them and inheriting the disease. And if you do get the gene, then you're at almost 90%, 99% risk to have that gene manifest itself sometimes in your lifetime. And now the thing about this disease is it can start at any time. I've seen patients as young as 2 years old and as old as 82 that lived a healthy life without the disease and just had it start at age 80. So it can have an age of onset at any age, but the average age of onset is 39. So it's right in the middle of life when you're raising your kids and working at your job and wanting to continue. And so we're trying to figure out how to, if we can't completely treat it or cure it, then we want to delay its onset and move it back a little bit.
And Kelly, this is an issue obviously very close to home for you. Your mom had the disease and passed away from it. Can you talk about the impact it had on her and your family?
Sure, absolutely. So my mom passed away in 2015, and I was about 11 years old when I started noticing her symptoms. So I was pretty young, and the first change that I noticed or how I understood it was she was having some mood swings, and just I couldn't really, as a child, understand what was going on at that time. So over the years, we did unfortunately watch her decline. My grandpa passed away before her, and I did have another family member pass away as well from this disease. But I've been pretty shy about my experience, just not really wanting to talk about it because it's really sad. And this was the year that I was just ready to talk about it because there's a lot that doesn't get talked about, especially around like the mental health that goes into this for those who have the disease and then also those who live at risk and family members who are around them. So it's a pretty traumatic thing to watch. But now I'm here and I'm ready. We're actively involved in the HDSA Wisconsin chapter. We do a lot of the walks with them, and they do a gala every year in Madison that we love to attend. We've been going there for about 8 years, I think, just doing what we can to raise money and spread awareness to hopefully find a cure someday.
Let's talk about treatment and cures, Jane. Right now, what does treatment for Huntington's disease look like?
The treatments are only for the symptoms. So Kelly did a really nice job of explaining the disease itself. It does share things with Alzheimer's disease in that you do have cognitive or thinking changes. It shares things with Parkinson's disease because you do have a movement disorder, only the movements are not like a tremor. They're like a dance movement, full body. And the part that people don't talk about that has too much stigma is the mental health issues. It also has a depression, anxiety component, which a lot of brain diseases do, and it doesn't get enough attention or appreciation or validation by the community. And so I think Kelly was very astute in bringing that up for us, and that it's all three things that people have to face: their physical limitations with the movement disorder, their cognitive limitations with the thinking changes, and their mood changes with the regulation problem with the psychiatric disorder.
And Jane, can you talk about the research you're working on? If I understand correctly, you're looking at possible ways of preventing the onset of these symptoms, even in people with this genetic change. Can you talk about what you're working on?
Yes, since right now all we do is treat those three symptoms, the movement, the mood, or the thinking, what we're looking at is trying to go in and actually do gene modifications to see if they can slow the disease progression. And so far, they are doing this clinical trial in a gene therapy clinical trial in three different ways in humans right now, which means it's fairly far along. It's already went through all the animal testing and proved to be efficacious and safe in animals, and now we're doing it in humans. And one is a gene specific that will dampen the entire HD gene, so it doesn't let your DNA tells the body what to do with that protein or with that cell. And if we dampen the whole gene, we don't let it do its thing. So one of the gene therapies will dampen the whole gene. The other gene therapies only dampens the gene that has the mutated Huntington's part so that the other gene can just do whatever it's supposed to do to be healthy. And the third way, if you go in permanently with a brain surgery and one time change the DNA. So all three methods. The first two are with infusions that go up the spinal cord, and they're called antisense oligonucleotides. Those are both happening now. And the third one has just started the surgery, and they've only completed two patients. But all of these are happening in people with the diagnosis, like Kelly said, very difficult to see in your loved ones, very difficult to care for as they lose their capacity to operate their motor, their thinking, and their mood, and to see them lose their capacity to enjoy life over time. But if we can start it before the people get sick, then maybe we can just make it a late life disease, and maybe they'd all get sick at age 70 or 80 or 90 or later. So that is the idea, is if these gene therapies could be given to people earlier.
Now, Kelly, I grew up as a fan of the folk singer Arlo Guthrie, and his father, Woody Guthrie, had passed away from Huntington's. And I always thought, what is it like to live with that possibility hanging over your head? Am I going to have that too? And that's where you are, right? Can you talk about knowing that this is a possibility for you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty stressful thinking about, I think especially going into family planning would be the most stressful part, is deciding whether or not to get tested. So right now I have chosen not to get tested, and my husband and I actually have decided to not have children anytime soon. So I don't really want to live with that information hanging over my head, just knowing, okay, like, you're going to get sick at this age, maybe should you start living your life differently? And I've kind of just been like, nope, going to live my life the same way. Maybe I have it, maybe I don't. And that's kind of what's been getting me through.
If research like Jane's provides treatments that seem like they're helping, would that change the equation for you? Would you want to get tested if there's the prospect of some kind of effective prevention of that gene manifesting itself?
I've never even thought of that, to be honest. I think maybe, depending on what was involved with the testing. The last time I even thought about getting testing, it was a huge process where you had to meet with a counselor first. Totally understandable, and I just wasn't ready to do any of that. So it's been easier for me to just not do anything, but if there's a chance to get the treatment, and then you would have to know, and then I would absolutely reconsider, and that's very exciting. Every year at the events that we go to, they talk about research updates, and it's so exciting to hear that we're getting closer.
And Jane, I believe you're looking for participants in your research. If people out there with Huntington's disease or with a risk of it are interested, can they get on board?
Yes, and I just want to comment that I think Kelly brought up really the most important thing in my research has been that the families have asked us to please try to slow it down earlier rather than later. We don't want to prolong suffering. We want to avoid any decline in hurt in your life. And so Kelly has the right idea that until we have something to offer, I understand that it's a very personal choice. And everybody has to make that decision for themselves of whether they want to know, because you can't put the information back. Once you know what your future has and what your DNA is, then you know. So the people I work with and I have in my research are people that have chosen to know. They're people like Kelly who are young and healthy and have a family member with Huntington's disease, but they have decided that for them to just get up in the morning and start the next day, they do better with that information. Now, there's all different types of people. There's people that don't need the information. Kelly said, I'm just going to live my best life every day. You know, none of us have a guarantee on our future. I think Kelly's spot right on that. And, you know, we've got to live our best life with what we're given every day. And we have no prediction of our future that's guaranteed. But for some people, there's too much anxiety with the uncertainty. And I think we can all appreciate how bad uncertainty can feel now during this COVID crisis. And uncertainty is a very uncomfortable feeling. So if people can learn, will I get it? How old will I be? How should I plan ahead with my finances, my insurance, my childbearing, you know, my education? Some people do better with the information. So the people I need are the ones that already decided they're going to do it for themselves. Because it's so important to put yourself first. Do what's best for you first. And then if you can, we need you for research to learn more about this disease and help others. But really, you got to put your mask on first in the airplane right when it goes down. And in this case, to take care of yourself first. And if you're someone who can get tested and then volunteer for our research, that is fabulous. And we welcome you. So I definitely want those people to reach out, as well as people who have been diagnosed if they're very early in the disease, and volunteer so that we can figure out a way to prevent this disease from happening.
Jane, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And Kelly, thanks for sharing your story.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. And thank you, Jane, as well.
Oh, Kelly, you're a pioneer and you're going to set the stage for everyone. Thank you for your courage.
Thank you.
Jane Paulson is a research faculty member at UW-Madison's neurology department. She's getting ready to run a study that would determine if Huntington's disease and its symptoms can be prevented. And Kelly Koberger is a volunteer with the Wisconsin chapter of the Huntington's Disease Society of America. Huntington's disease runs in her family. Coming up, we'll get the latest on Wisconsin's certification of the presidential election.